Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, thanks a lot. So now we are ready to start the round table. So the moderator is Simon Brunel from the Bank of France. And so the panelists are Céline Antonin from the OFSE, Francesco Filippucci from the OECDE, and Philine Widmer from the Paris School of Economics.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Ignazio, for those enlightening opening remarks. So I'm delighted to be moderating this panel. And so I thank you, you three, Céline, Philine, and Francesco, for agreeing to share your thoughts and insights on the impact of AI on policymaking. And so over the past years, and you mentioned this, Ignacio and Philippe did also this morning, several influential reports have highlighted the urgent need for Europe to awaken and reverse its decline in productivity compared to the US and China in particular. And we saw it in the Letta report, the Tier 1 Quota report, the Draghi report. And as Philippe showed us this morning, there are reasons to believe that AI could be an opportunity to revitalize productivity growth in Europe. Francesco, I know you have been working actually extensively on this topic recently. Could you share your thoughts on your potential on the potential impacts of AI on productivity and its policy implications, of course?
Yes. Thank you, Simon. As we didn't expect this question, we prepared some slides to better visualize the answer. But I hope this will be useful for the audience to understand a bit what is our stance on productivity gains from AI across the Atlantic. I guess we need to press there. So yes, there is a pre-existing productivity divide over which AI is arriving. We know that Europe and US have been growing differently in terms of productivity, at least since the 2000s. But what's interesting to see is that when you decompose across sectors, this productivity growth in the US is much stronger in those sectors that we know being the incubators of AI. So those sectors that both are, we know, where it's more likely to happen AI innovation, and also that will be mostly affected by AI, according to exposure measures. These sectors are ICT, finance, and professional services. And maybe not surprisingly, but quite stunningly yet, you see a huge spike in AI patents. It is pre-gen AI in China and the US and Europe, you know, trying to catch up, but barely at half of that level. So motivated by that, what we tried to do, this is forthcoming from our team, is to replicate what Philippe, the kind of exercise that Philippe introduced this morning, to try to estimate the productivity gains of AI. Again, let me stress that this is only, is excluding the potential effect that AI could have on innovation. So not only for the US, as has been done by Philippe Simon and Darren Acemoglu, but also for all the G7 countries. And you can see two things. First, our estimate is a bit in between the optimistic and pessimistic ones, more in line with the one produced by Philippe and Simon for the US. But then there is quite some cross-country heterogeneity, and this is driven by the fact that first, some countries have a lower share of the economy composed of those sectors, finance, professional services, that are likely to be mostly affected by AI. This is the case, for example, of Italy and Japan, but also Germany. And other countries compound that with a very low expected adoption rate. So most of this analysis has been devoted to try to harmonize adoption estimates across countries, to estimate future adoption in a consistent way across countries. Data there on AI adoption are very heterogeneous, very hard to come with an harmonized strategy there. And it ends up that, you know, Italy, Japan, but also France to some extent are further damaged by this kind of dynamic of potentially lower adoption in the future. And then what we do is also disentangle a bit the mechanism. So we try to see the AI shock with the lenses of a general equilibrium model, multi-sectoral general equilibrium model, and we see that there are two key drivers that policy can exploit to maximize the productivity gains from AI. So the first one is adoption. Perhaps unsurprisingly, if governments manage to achieve higher adoption, in a high adoption scenario, gains from AI tend to double. Here you see that for the US. But then also we try to quantify what has been evocated before. So the possibility of a Baumol effect. So in the words of Aguillon, Johnson, Jones, this is the idea that growth may be constrained not by what we're good at, but rather by what is essential and yet hard to improve. So the fact that some sectors benefit from AI, but others don't. And so factors and consumption may reallocate to try to sustain production in those sectors that do not experience productivity gains or into new tasks that for which demand may arise as demand for AI-enhanced goods will saturate in the future. And so what is interesting to see is that this Baumol effect is higher first when the shock of the AI shock is more uneven across sectors, when it's more concentrated in some sectors. And second, in a situation where reallocation of factors, so capital and labor, is more difficult across sectors. So this is interesting from a policy standpoint because it suggests that, you know, those countries that have labor markets and capital markets that are more able to efficiently reallocate factors to sectors where are most needed might suffer less from this Baumol growth disease. So with these two potential policy implications, I think I hope this answers your question. Yeah.
Thanks, Francesco. Céline, do you have something to add on this productivity effect?
Yeah, maybe, thank you. Maybe quickly, so I just wanted to add two things, in fact. It's first that I wanted to point out that since the 1990s, the US has seen a stronger productivity growth than Europe, and it was largely thanks to a massive investment in the ICTs, so a gap in the investment. But I wanted just to remind you that there is a continuum between ICTs and AI, and that ICTs, so information and communication technologies, are the basic infrastructure for AI. And so AI adoption is always preceded by digitization of firms. And so since Europe is lagging behind, for instance, you have 45 of companies that use cloud computing. In the EU, it's the double in the US. So this lag is holding back the adoption of AI. Which is a source of future productivity. So Europe should close the ICT gap first, and there is an emergency. And my second point is the fact that there can be also a bottleneck between sectors that should be solved. So like Francesco showed, there is also, we saw it's very different between sectors, the impact of AI. And I'm currently working with my colleagues in the spirit also of what Acemoglu, Autor, and Patterson are doing on the fact that a sector's productivity does not solely depend on its own innovation, but also on of the innovation of the other sectors. And so if you don't have, if you have some sectors that strongly innovate and some that do not innovate, you have big bottlenecks that can arise and that will inhibit the innovation process. So policies should be also more balanced between sectors and target the diffusion of ICTs and AI across all sectors. So for me, it's also essential to strengthen this technological absorption capacity of the less innovative sectors that you showed at the beginning.
And so maybe to build on this, so you mentioned the fact that Europe is already lagging behind due to the first ICT revolution, and probably because Europe has made some mistakes in managing the first wave of digital transformation, especially with regards to our dependence on US tech, on cloud computing, on semiconductors, on this kind of technologies. How do you see the relationship between economic sovereignty and the productivity gains promised by AI adoption? Are they mutually exclusive or can we combine them? So maybe Céline, you start on this and then fill in.
So I wouldn't say that sovereignty and productivity gains are totally mutually exclusive, but still sovereignty clearly matters. Just to remind you the definition of what technological sovereignty is, so it applies the ability to make autonomous decisions on technology development without excessive influence or dependence on outside entities. So why it matters if, for instance, AI, so I take the European perspective, if, for instance, AI is imported from the US GAFAM only, European productivity may increase, but for instance, you will have a capture of the value chain, so the profit margins will be captured by AI suppliers rather than by European developers. You have also a risk of supply disruption, and for instance, if you don't have any champions, European champions in key areas like chips, like large language models, like cloud, you have a structural dependence. And it could harm Europe, for instance, if you have some unexpected events like geopolitical conflict or regulatory disagreement, for instance. And you can think, for instance, of the recent US ban in the export of semiconductor to China. So you can maybe not transpose the thing for Europe, but still. And you have also, like Noah showed this morning, the issue of data control. So AI relies heavily on data. And if European data is processed by US companies, Europe will lose its control over the economic exploitation of that data. So I don't know if I have one minute left. So I have also, there is a specific EU issue that I wanted to highlight as well, is the fact that the AI value chain is not sufficiently integrated. And for instance, you have, if you take a linear chain, which is composed of techniques, functions and applications, so you go from upstream to downstream, you see that there is in Europe a weak integration in the AI value chain compared to the US. And so you have, for instance, Canada, China, US, which are highly integrated, but here in Europe, well, maybe not in all countries because Germany is more integrated. It means you have more complementarities between, for instance, techniques and functions or functions and applications, but it's not the case in France. And if you have some specialization without this integration, there is a risk that it will remain just, for instance, research, and it will not be integrated in the production chain, and then it will not create jobs and growth. So my policy implication is that you need this better integration of the value chain. You don't need to be good at everything, but you have to choose a few sectors and to be an expert in all these sectors from the top to the bottom of the chain.
Fill in maybe this relationship between sovereignty and productivity gains. How do you see it? Share this perspective.
So yeah, I'm not an expert for productivity, but I'm working on political economy and the media. And I think when we think about technology, one aspect of sovereignty that we also have to look at is regarding like public information. Because just as an example, when X or Twitter was taken over by Elon Musk, a lot of European media, European politicians, they had the question, are we still going to support this platform? Because it had established itself as kind of the marketplace for idea, the marketplace for information. And then all of a sudden, then you have this change and you're like, wow, this has actually become a key piece of our communication infrastructure. So how are we dealing with this? And in some sense, it's actually, I think it's nice if you kind of think of the world as some like non-fragmented entity that we all come together on these platforms and that we use the same kind of tools if you think of ChatGPT. But in another way, it's also completely crazy to think just how much information we give away by using these tools. And I think this is another type of sovereignty question that I'm personally a bit worried about. Because when things go well, it's not a problem. But, or another example, if you think back in February, there were elections in Germany and a lot of people did use social media for their information. And there was, because social media, it's open, anyone can go there. So nobody precludes foreign actors from taking a huge influence and potentially, I mean, it's very hard to measure, but to have this like very, very wide access to the population. And I think these are important questions where I feel we have slept a bit and we're only to realize now just how important this is in this like information-driven environment.
Yes, thank you very much. I mean, regarding also the global impact of AI, expected impact of on productivity, one question that arises is the competition among the AI value chain. And I mean, in France, we had this idea since last June when the French authority, competition authority, came out with this report saying that there is a huge problem among the AI value chain in Europe and in France. Then Benoît Cœuré told us that AI was a French technology to be dominated from the outset by major players. And more recently, actually, forthcoming OECD working paper suggests that if we consider the different bricks of the AI value chain, competition might actually be stronger than what it was it initially appears. Francesco, do you have some elements to share on this?
Yes, so this is a bit of a trickier field in a sense. So it is true that we have forthcoming results today. It's also true, as Governor Visco pointed out, that we have a previous paper where having more of sort of an holistic approach where we look at, you know, the qualitatively at the matter, we were like, okay, we should be worried about that, a bit like we ended up waiting too much for ICT, for acting on competition in the ICT markets. Maybe we will do the same mistakes for AI. So then we tried to look at a bit into the issue quantitatively. So we came up with graphs like this one, where we collect basically the price for which different models are offered and the quality for which different models perform. And we built sort of a frontier, quality price frontier. So with different models having, you know, higher prices, higher quality, or lower prices for lower model, lower prices for lower quality. And what you can see is that, you know, this frontier is actually moving fast. So between the beginning of 2023 and nowadays, the frontier moves exponentially to the left with exponentially lower prices for higher quality. And besides having, you know, some high quality models that tend to be from OpenAI, tend to be from always from the same company, there is a number of other companies from different countries. There is also France there also to answer concerns of your competition authority. Of course, most from USA and China, but there are many other Europeans just in the back that specialize on different segments of the demand for, you know, higher price, high quality, lower price, lower quality. Now, that not to say that competition is in a good shape. I mean, competition is a different object. It's difficult to assess switching costs. If there is, you know, that looks like there is a race. The race sometimes is for a price. So there is a concern that these companies are racing to get some sort of market dominance there to arrive, I don't know, to, depends from the nature of the technology. If the technology is such that once you arrive to artificial general intelligence, you are able to dominate the market and offer high quality, low quality, in the most competitive way. But on the other hand, there might also be a scenario where, you know, they're just like humans specialize on different aspects of intelligence, they have different comparative advantages, different models have different comparative advantages, and different companies specialize in this aspect. So it's true, there is a risk intrinsic into the wait and see approach. We're trying to speed up our research to get a stance on that. More precisely, but by now it's we still don't see this winner takes all dynamic arising live. Mm.
And also, this work brings some elements on the table to be discussed. I mean, exactly. You have real figures to and on the different bricks of the.
Of course, there is no quantity there. This is really just quantity, observing quantity, especially as these companies are, most of them are private. It's very hard.
And so in this context, Céline, is industrial policy the right tool to foster innovation in AI, especially in Europe, for instance? Is it a right tool to be used at the second leg with the competition authority?
Yeah, so I think we should combine industrial policy and competition policy. So as regards industrial policy, I think that there are several points that were also already mentioned by Philippe this morning. So I will just recall a few of them. So you should support open source AI models first. We should also bear in mind that we should fund public computing infrastructure as well. So for instance, have supercomputers or public clouds. We should also, and this is important, provide an equitable access to data by creating, for instance, public data trusts, which would be accessible to new entrants. And also urge platforms to share non-sensitive data, so in health and in other sectors. We should also make public aid conditional on non-exclusivity, that is to say that there are many public aids that are dedicated to projects that are co-financed with the GAFAMs. But in fact, this co-finance technology should remain open to other players, and this could be via open APIs or non-exclusive licenses, for instance. And apart from this industrial policy, we should as well have an efficient competition policy. So Philippe already mentioned this morning this book by Richard Gilbert. And it's really this idea of going from a very static view of the competition to a more dynamic view of competition, which is not solely based on the relevant market definition, the market share, but really see the costs and benefits of a merger and also see the anticipated impact of a merger, for instance, on innovation and the creation of new markets. So we should also shift our paradigm and also maybe move from an a posteriori regulation to an a priori regulation, and like in the Digital Market Act, that we should take well, we should maybe have this kind of idea to have really obligations for gatekeepers, and we should really think about being more a priori than a posteriori.
Okay. And Philine, so do you think that this lack of competition on the AI value chain, could also influence political opinions? Is it a problem? This maybe this winner takes it all perspective for a political economy.
Yeah, so I think right now when we talk about AI and political opinions, we typically think of social media or perhaps large language models. So if we think of these, I think market concept, I mean, we want plurality, but like high market shares per se are not necessarily the problem, if you let me draw an analogy with traditional media, because providing high quality content comes with a huge fixed cost. So if you think of the BBC with like offices all around the world, that's very different from a small news outlet that just produces a couple of stories. So in some sense, the kinds of the kinds of information that maybe that we want, they do require size. What makes social media in part so successful is that it draws on huge amounts of information. The same for large language models. They wouldn't be so successful if they weren't called large language models. So in some sense, we want plurality, but I don't think we can think of this as like the ideal case would most certainly not be an atomistic market in many scenarios, if we can learn something from traditional media markets. I think also if we abstract a bit what you said, if we abstract from this possibility of artificial generalized intelligence, what we will likely see is also some kind of specialization. There could be regional specialization, that some models are better for certain types of politically relevant information. And I think there would even be opportunity for specialization with respect to reliability, because perhaps for some business applications, we need performance along a particular margin, but providing reliable political information, it's maybe a business in itself. And with, like with any business, with a lot of positive externalities, chances are that it's going to be underprovided. So here, I also think when we talk about like investments to be made, it's something we have to keep in mind a bit, like in the very same way that we have thought about these questions for traditional media, and increasingly also start thinking about them for social media, and I think then in consequence later also for large language models.
Thanks. Maybe to come back to something we evocated this morning during the conference, so employment and skills, there is this, of course, huge debate with amazing figures, the IMF saying that 60% of jobs in the advanced economy are exposed to AI on the medium run. Céline, what are your thoughts on the impact of AI on labor markets, and also what are the policies that we should prioritize in also a context of complicated budget, for instance, in Europe. So in terms of education, of course, in terms of reskilling, how do you see a priority to transform our economies to AI?
So we have two possible effects. We mentioned them this morning, so I won't talk more about this, but we have this kind of substitution effect that the tasks are shifted from the humans to the machines, and we have the productivity effect, so that says that in fact it is a positive effect of AI on labor. So in fact, what has been done up to now is two kinds of approaches. So you have the observed firm level approach, what we see, for instance, with Brynjolfsson's study, and you look at the impact of AI adoption in businesses and on its consequences. The pro is the fact that you have real data, so this is very, very nice, but the con is the fact that you have little insight, especially on generative AI. So this is the first approach. The second one is the prospective task-based approach, and Simon, you recall the results of the study from the OECD. And so here you have a forward-looking approach, so you try to imagine what is going to happen if some of the tasks are shifted from humans to machines. What you see from these studies is that the main takeaways, I would say, is that AI will disrupt many jobs. So you have these big disparities between, for instance, IMF and OECD, but still you see that AI will disrupt many jobs, like previous GPTs did. For instance, let me recall you what Autor said about jobs. He said that he said that 60% of jobs did not exist 80 years before. So what is different with AI is that, unlike previous revolution, this time it's middle and even high-level professions that will be most affected, because AI has made much more progress in abstract reasoning and high-level cognitive tasks, rather in, for instance, physical engagement in space, for instance, the coordination between thought and machine. So the policy implications are, for first, of course, you have to invest much in initial education. I know our budget is constrained, but still. So you have several kinds of profile. You have the engineers, which design and develop AI solutions, and you have to invest to have more of these STEM engineers. You have the managers, which will not be at the core of AI, but still they need to develop AI solutions within the company. And the rest, you have to raise awareness of AI for the rest of the population. You should also largely increase the number of people who are trained in AI. And for instance, you should upgrade PhDs. You should strengthen the math skills, so especially us in France. You should also create new fields of study. And for instance, dual diplomas between AI and law, AI and medicine, AI and sociology, for instance. You also need to rethink the teaching methods, and new pedagogies will arise, and you should develop, in fact, what is human. What is human is critical thinking, so you should build on this. You have also an issue with reskilling, lifelong learning, of course. And a last point I wanted to make is the role of firms in all this, and the fact that unions have a positive impact, and we already saw in some studies, for instance, Belloc and his co-authors, that showed that they have a positive impact on the adoption of new technologies, and especially AI. And so if you don't work against the workforce, but you work with them and you accompany them on AI, you will you will be much more efficient, and it will benefit the firm much more.
Okay, so thanks, Céline. So, and maybe to take the opposite direction, using AI for policymaking, we saw, for instance, in Roland's presentation, this morning, that AI may help us improve our public services. Céline, do you think that AI could become a valuable tool for supporting public decision making, given all the biases we saw this morning and you work on?
So I think the question is more, they probably already are, because a lot of public administrators are probably using AI, politicians are using AI, citizens are using AI. So I think in some sense they already are, but I guess what you're after with the question is more like kind of institutionalized use, which is not to say that this other use is very consequential too. But I think it necessarily will become an important tool, because given like the economies that we are in, you can't work well without a lot of data, without complex analysis of this data. So we wouldn't, like, why would we not use that in the public sector, right? Just from a pure, we want to make public services comparable to like the quality that you have in private services viewpoint. So the question is more like, how are we going to do it? And I think here we just need very, very clear rules and protocols of how they are going to be used. Because I think now oftentimes we're again a bit in this like reactive position, where we use solutions that were developed perhaps by providers with a clear business motive, but we don't understand exactly how this business motive might interfere with other like public policy motives that we have. Again, if you think about the example of social media, we've heard it this morning, they're aiming to drive engagement, but what does this mean, for example, for our information environment? So I think this is very important, and I also think that if we want to I mean, I still think that it's necessarily going to happen. So I think we should also think more about audits. And when I say audits, we've heard a lot about a lot of nice studies, but I don't think that the occasional study uncovering a certain bias or pointing out a certain problem will do. I think we need really some kind of continuous monitoring when these things are used at scale, both institutionally or in the population. And if you think about it, it's a magnificent thing that I can go pretty much wherever in this city and eat something, and in all likelihood I'm not going to be food poisoned, but this is also in part or in large part a result of regulation, and bad things have happened, people have died of food poisoning, and then we started implementing hygiene protocols, we started implementing audits, so now there's this kind of minimum standard of quality that we can expect. And for AI, it's of course, when we talk about bias and these things, it's very complex to measure, but I still think we should engage in this debate, because if it becomes like a technology that everybody uses pretty much all the time, I think we should really think about what would be these protocols, what would be these audits, where do they matter the most? And I think this question, where do they matter the most, is also important, because we heard it this morning, we wouldn't want to overburden our economies with regulation. But nevertheless, I think, especially in these like crucial areas, healthcare, defense, political information, etc., it's definitely a conversation that we must have.
Thanks. Francesco, in your view, or OECD's view, how can AI best support policymaking? How do you see?
So in my view, as departments.
Let's stick with your view.
From what I know. So I wanted to say just maybe one word on adoption, because so we see adoption in the public sector being actually high, not so far from what is in the private sector. But maybe that tells you more about what does adoption mean. If you look at US data on the whole economy, you know, there is 20%, so it was 20% at the beginning of 24, firms saying that they use AI, but much lower, like 5% saying that they use AI in the last 2 weeks. So productive use of AI, what you said before, systemic institutional adoption of AI, is something quite different than your employees using ChatGPT once in a while. So what we see when you look behind this adoption figure of the public sector is that the use case is, at least we did a survey among economic policymakers, so ministries of finance and central banking, what they declare AI being used for is mostly economic forecasting, banking supervision, some tax enforcement. This is likely more related to old-fashioned machine learning, and of course, probably behind the scenes, there is a lot of, you know, LLMs for writing emails. And the quality of English in emails in these circles has improved massively since a year or so. But you know, there is hundreds of ways you can use this to improve government. I mean, we know that this has huge effects on customer services. Government interacts with citizens regularly. We know this has huge effects on education, can optimize transportation, can be used for security, even with all the caveats, in fact, to be kept in mind. Clearly, adoption in the public sector is key for this kind of tool. And there are clear barriers. And one of these, I guess, security and the slippery slope of regulation and trade-offs between privacy and et cetera is one. One that has not been mentioned is skills. Still in this survey that we fielded with economic policymakers, they suggested that yes, they adopt AI, but this has no effect on recruitment. So this is at odds with what you see in the private sector. You know that in the private sectors, AI changes the way firms recruit, changes the kind of profile that firms have in their rankings. And so that's another challenge for the private sector, having public services that adapts to this kind of new technology.
Thanks. Maybe a last question, and then I open. How much time do we have left? 10 minutes.
Well, actually, 1 minute.
1 minute, but we start. Let's find. So one last point, maybe just for filling on the question, for the point you were mentioning on the fact that you have interaction between citizens and the state. And I mean, we saw this morning the bias that could occur through social networks. How could we ensure, how can we preserve our modern democracies given these biases that could occur? So overall through social networks, but through the AI use with the state. How do you see it, Philine? And maybe then, if we have time, we'll take one or two questions from the audience.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly hard because bias can take so many forms. It's not just about, for example, for my own research, I know that depending on what you ask certain LLMs, just the length of the answer will vary a lot, depending on whether you ask for one political viewpoint or another, and you get a much shorter or much more elaborate answer. The LLMs oftentimes even can't distinguish between scenarios where you're asking for like a positive answer versus a normative answer. So if you ask things like, what does this politician think about this and that topic, which is a very factual question, in fact, the LLM would be overridden with some kind of normative bias and give you an inaccurate answer that has a certain political color. So I think that's very hard. I think one of the answers that I would give is that we need to mandate the companies to disclose how their models operate. And I think typically what companies would often tell you is, yeah, but we don't have a political agenda. But I don't think that we should be happy with this answer, because it's not the end of the story. These models are so complex, so there are tons of correlates of whatever business motive, even like potentially neutral business motive, that they're maximizing it. So I think we should really ask these questions regarding the questions that matter for us. For example, if you have a recruitment system, do you think about certain types of biases that we request that the models that are used, especially by the state, but also by large and private actors, that they do have a sense themselves about what could be the potential correlates of these so-called neutral business. I mean, it's not to say that their business motives might not be per se political neutral, but I think just in consequence, and as economists, we're very familiar with this concept of the unintended, perhaps even unintended consequences. So I think this will be very important, especially since with the generative artificial intelligence, it's not just about selection, but it's really about, there's so many margins along which you can start to optimize. If we think about information, you can change the tone of voice, the color of scheme of the image, the exact way it's phrased. I think it just really raises a lot of kind of David versus Goliath problems also, because I think for an individual user, the complexity of these models, they go way beyond what they could potentially grasp. So they can't even, if they wanted to, potentially anticipate all the ways in which they're like influenced in a certain direction. So I think this, you discussed this morning about new roles for the state. I think this will also be a very important new role of the state in this era.
Thanks. Thank you very much to the three of you for your fascinating insights. Do we have time for one question maybe from the audience? Or
Yes, we can. So, thanks all the panelists for the great conversation. So we may have some time. So
no, I only want to make one point, as has been said, on how to use artificial intelligence by policymakers. The big problem is policymakers need to understand what is the result of generative AI applied. And you need a narrative. And if you cannot generate a narrative out of the black box, it is very difficult that this will be transferred in actual policy making. It's very different from using machine learning or even neural networks that are more or less easier to identify. But if you cannot identify, if you don't have explainability, it is very hard that you can see it in actual policymaking. This is why I was stressing the need to go back and in the regulatory frame, in the actions to improve the reduce concentration, improve competition. But actual policymaking is very hard.
Anyone of you want to? Yeah, no.
Maybe just to say that that applies to several sectors, applies to medicine, I guess, to legal services. So it is particularly an issue for policymaking, because we want our policymakers to be transparent, but there are some use cases where we could afford some higher adoption, I don't know, in relationship with citizens or in, you know, optimization of some kinds of allocation of funds and things like this. That, you know, we use AI in things that are much more crucial. And I agree that, you know, criticality is often used as a dimension lowering the substitutability of workers or from AI. But government is not the only one scoring high on criticality. Not all tasks of government score high on criticality. Paradoxically, some that probably score high, such as monetary policy forecasting, they are using AI more than others. So I understand that the willingness of policymakers to understand, which is welcome especially, is a potential barrier, but but cannot be, you know, an insurmountable one.
Can I have 2 seconds?
I just wanted to make a very short technical comment about what you said with the explainable AI, because I think here we have really reached a bit the frontier of computer science research also, because there was this new generation of reasoning models and everybody was very enthusiastic. Okay, now they explain why they do what they do, but more recent research even suggests that the reasoning is learned too. So it's really like, I think we're at the frontier. We don't know yet how we can achieve this explainability in these incredibly complex models that are sadly the most performant ones.
Maybe, yeah, just maybe to bounce back. I think it also depends, and your question raises that, I mean, it also depends on the place we want to give to AI. And what is important is that we have to decide which place do we want for AI in future society. So there is all the improvements on the one hand, but there is also what we want as citizens, as political citizens, what we want to do with AI. So I think, yeah, here there should be more education, more of many things on AI, but really we should decide also what we want to make of it. And this is maybe not really clear at this stage.
We have, yeah, time for... Do you want to make a questions? I think...
A couple of points. First of all, it's one is a comment. It's almost an elephant in the room. When quantum computing arrives, and it's arriving soon, sooner than we thought, that's going to boost AI capabilities by a big, big jump. And that's something that's worrying because we're not ready for it. The other is a question to Governor Visco. I can see how property rights transfers can happen in a static environment, but in a dynamic environment, it's going to be difficult because we're talking about transfers to people who are constrained and budget constrained, and they will liquidate this property right. Then you have one of two choices as a government. Do you do it again, in which case there's a moral hazard problem that you're encouraging, or do you stop? So it's going to require more than that. It's going to require some creative solution that I don't have an answer to yet. Maybe you do.
I mean, you made a statement and you gave the answer that is a very uncertain issue. I don't know. I mean, I don't have an answer to that. Obviously, there are many things that you could do and with results that perhaps would be negative. So you have always trade-offs and you have to evaluate what is the benefit, what is the cost of what you're doing. But really, it is an issue which cannot be answered now.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.